Dr. Bryce reported that these were horrible health conditions and was being deliberately created to spread disease. They then abolished medical inspection. And as a result, this is the TB rate in the Indian world in British Columbia after the abolition of the medical inspection. Look what happens. The tuberculosis rate increases dramatically. So all of that, you know, in the 10 years after that, they bring in compulsory sterilization laws, compulsory attendance. They force everybody into the schools even though they're death traps.
Mm.
And they abolish legal control of native parents over their own kids. And they transfer the guardianship rights to the churches from the government. So they're giving the churches carte blanche to do anything. You couldn't hire a lawyer if you're in India. It's all created to wipe out people. And there's no more concrete evidence than that.
Right.
Yet they're still saying it wasn't intentional.
But really, it's not a eugenics program. Really,
it's absurd.
No, it's not.
No.
No. And I think the eugenics program is a real, real thing. And I think it's more widespread than people are aware.
And, you know, it's right in the laws. Like, here's another thing I found. This is the sterilization law in British Columbia, 1933. And same year as Adolf Hitler came to power, interestingly. The sterilization laws in North America were copied in Europe during the 30s and 40s. These laws allowed the sterilization of any native child in a residential school, but the decision of one man, the principal. And
okay, now, let me get this straight. The principal of the internment, I'm sorry, school, was able to just say, across the board, sterilize children?
Yes.
Above or below this age?
Any age. Usually the standard policy was when children reached puberty, they were sterilized, especially if they weren't going to church and they were traditional, holding on to their language. They were targeted. The traditional chiefs were targeted for that eugenics program. And also, I've interviewed people in British Columbia and Alberta, both, from different areas, who said the same thing. If their marks were too high, they were given a red tag. They had to report to the infirmary. They were sterilized. So the program of wiping out the more intelligent group members of a group...
Their marks were too high.
Too high. If they got very high marks, they were sterilized. That was reported in the Alberni Residential School, run by the United Church, and in the LeJack School, run by the Catholic Church in British Columbia. So, I mean, you know, that's a sure sign of genocide when you're targeting a group like that to make them infertile.
Did you have the opportunity to interview a lot of people that had this done to them?
A few of them. In our movie Unrepentant, we quote four of them. And these people, naturally, especially the women, they're very, you know, they carry a lot of shame about that. And
very sensitive about
it. So they didn't actually appear on the screen, but we have their affidavit statements. Mm-hmm. And I've met these people. There's whole clusters of them who survived these things on Vancouver Island, especially.
And since then, and since the film, you've met quite a few people.
Well, more people come forward all the time. Mm-hmm. There really isn't enough time in the day to interview all these people.
Yeah.
The people who contact me, I don't have the money or the means to get around mm-hmm. to interview everybody. And now that the government has set up their phony Truth and Reconciliation Commission, everybody's thinking that's some kind of investigation, but it isn't. When you read their mandate, they have no power to subpoena documents, so the churches can decide what to show them. The churches even helped appoint the commissioners, so it's kind of like the serial killer getting to appoint the jury and the judge. You can't name names, you can't talk about wrongdoing that happened in the school, and the churches are absolved from any wrongdoing. You can't sue them anymore for any of this stuff. So that's set up to protect the perpetrator, not to bring out the truth. You know?
So that's like, we'll talk about it under our rules.
Exactly.
And our rules are so stringent that nobody's going to be...
We're not guilty of anything.
They're going to be some random thing happened allegedly, and these people that we can't talk about were involved, who were members of a group, we're not going to say their name.
Well, there's no... It's kind of like you can, at a TRC forum, and I've been to... These are like, you know, a lot of hoopla in the media about these events, but all they are when you go, people will get up at the mic, they're given 5 minutes to speak usually, and the commissioners can hear what they have to say, but they can't record it as evidence. So, you know, it's fine, like, oh yeah, talk away, whatever you like, but it has no legal outcome, it has no consequence. Especially when the churches have already been absolved from any wrongdoing. So what difference does it make if you do an investigation? It's like saying, Peter Yilliquil is a friend of mine in Manitoba, and he got up at the mic and he said, you know what, an apology and healing and reconciliation in Canada is like, it's like if somebody steals your car, they come and knock on your door and say, gee, I'm really sorry I stole your car, and then they get in and drive it away again. You know, it's like, there's no concept, nothing changes, but they've said all the correct words, and then everyone thinks, oh, my conscience is absolved. doesn't change it. As a matter of fact, it makes it worse because the people I work with, when the compensation money began to come into the neighborhood in Vancouver where I worked, the alcoholism and drug abuse rate went way up. People started overdosing. You know, if you give $10,000 to somebody in the street, what do you think they're going to do with it? It's not enough for them to change their life. It's only enough to kill yourself with, and that's what I see on the ground all the time.
Okay.
So it's money thrown at individuals is a way to continue wiping out people. It's not a way to change anything.
Yeah, but I mean, that's why in most reservations, nothing has changed.
It's not meant to change.
There's absolutely no meant to change. Because all the money that just goes in, it just gets funneled into use.
Yep.
And the chiefs and a lot of these people are not really helping in progressing the situation.
The ones that are hooked into the governing council, as it were, they're sort of on board with the politicians. I mean, they become politicians,
you know. Chief and council, it's important to know, under the Indian Act, if you're elected chief and then council funded by Indian Affairs, you are a legal agent of the Crown of England.
Yeah.
Just like a member of Parliament is, the policeman, you know, the oath of allegiance to a member of Parliament is, I would swear true allegiance to Queen Elizabeth and her descendants, not to the people of Canada, not to the Constitution. So in effect, we are electing and paying for people who are not accountable to us, but to a foreign power.
Yeah.
Same with, there is no difference between that person, member of parliament, and a bank council chief. Mm-hmm. They're both serving the crown. So it doesn't really matter what they decide. It has no, we can't affect that legally. Mm-hmm.
So who are the spiritual, I mean, if they're handling the political leadership, who are the spiritual leaders?
The real spiritual leaders in the community are the traditional elders who have survived somehow. They've survived better in the East than in Western Canada. They were almost obliterated in the West. But in the East, you know, the Mohawks, the Six Nations Confederacy, hung on to a lot of their traditions because they were military allies of the British. They were able to get concessions that people in the West couldn't.
Yeah.
And so they've retained some of that. The clan mothers here were the ones who invited me in. They're the ones who say, and it was interesting, when they began the archaeological dig here at the Brantford School, they said right at the outset in a press release, we will not allow the RCMP onto this territory to declare it a crime site. We don't recognize the jurisdiction of Canada. This is under Ongwahanwe or Mohawk jurisdiction, and it always has been. So we have security here to protect the archaeological site, you know, that we're going to be digging.
But what are the like the laws when it comes to, you know, the reservations? Are they...
They're Crown lands.
They're still Crown lands.
Yeah, Indian reservations are held in, they say, in trust for Indians, like you're a child, we're holding in trust for you. But it's all authorities vested in the Crown. All land, including on reservations, is owned by the Crown.
So the RCMP still has...
Well, in their legal system of the Crown, you know, they will claim that they do. But the point is, it's interesting, this building we're in right now has been occupied for 3 years by the clan mothers. The government's never turned off the electricity. The RCMP will not, they'll come to the end of the driveway, but they won't enter the premises because they know... This is Mohawk land, and they don't want to force the issue in court because if it is forced, they'll have to bring up the whole Haldimand Tract, which was illegally signed away by a guy called Governor Bond Head in the 1840s.
Yeah.
He illegally just went, shh, no, it's not Mohawk land. If that issue was forced in court, every treaty since then has been fraudulent. Now, Canada doesn't want that proven in court, so they occupy a gray zone where they won't enforce it, but they won't back off either. They kind of hang on the edges hoping people forget history and won't act on their rights. And we'll be caught up in this false jurisdiction of the chief and council. Just like we do in the white society, you know, when we use our driver's license with the capital letters and all that.
Yeah.
It's the same fiction.
Or all of our bills that we get in capital letters.
It is the same fiction.
Yeah, it's a fiction. It's the straw man.
Right.
They're sending bills to the straw man.
Yeah.
Our listeners are are up on all of
it's
that.
It's the same system here in the Aboriginal world, too. And fortunately, there are some people here in the Native world as well who have woken up to that, who have always been aware of it, right? And they just simply say, well, this will be conducted under our jurisdiction. So it's exciting because it hasn't happened like that anywhere in Canada yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to allow us to be able to take this evidence, you know, outside the country, which is what you need to do because the courts have colluded in concealing this whole genocide.
Well, not too long ago when the H1N1 situation had occurred, I had heard of a story, and I guess it was on the radio here for a while, when the government has shipped a whole bunch of caskets to one of the reservations out in B.C.
Body bags.
Yeah. not knowing that they would get that H1. No, that reservation had an awful lot of...
Well, I was involved in that, actually, documenting that, because it happened at the Housed Indian Reservation, where when I was a minister, I used to work up there. I used to do funerals and weddings out at the Housed Reserve, and it's one of the most isolated places on the West Coast, and yet it's the first place they declared a pandemic zone.
Pandemic.
Now, how would that happen?
I couldn't figure that out.
Okay, the reason that happened is for about a year before that, Health Canada nurses had been going and pushing the Tamiflu vaccine on people, targeting them, because under the Indian Act, Section 76, if you're on reserve, you cannot refuse medical treatment. So they are built-in guinea pigs. They can't legally refuse. They could if they knew their nature, but they're when they're because of residential school and their own chief and council, they're all brainwashed to think they have to follow the authority of Canada. And they go in there, and they were giving people this drug, and a lot of them came down with a swine flu. So they were testing it out, and that's something a lot of people don't know about, that they were using.
This was like, when I first heard of it, because that was in the early stages when supposedly, it was coming out of Mexico, and, a few people had gone down there, and I think it was maybe a few weeks later, not even that long ago, and I heard the story, and I said to myself, how is it possible that this flu kind of like jumped? I mean, how many natives go to Mexico?
Exactly. Well, it's illustrating the fact that for a long time, indigenous people have been like the canary in the mine shaft.
Yeah,
they're the main target to try out a lot of stuff. Drug testing programs, experimental birth control devices were always tried out first in these Indian hospitals.
No, but this is the funny thing is when they were talking about that birth flu, that it wasn't a manufactured type of thing. So how does it get the people that are so isolated?
Introduced.
It was introduced with the Tamiflu injections. And
yeah, well, that's what they were doing when they first tested it back in, Europe.
Well, we know that, here's a fact a lot of people don't know, that the drug pharmaceutical companies, Big Pharma, have agreements with churches all over the world. There's a thing called the Institute for the Fund for Theological Education in America, and it funds all the seminaries. It's Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company. There's an agreement that has been for many years between the United Church and the Catholic Church to use kids in residential schools as drug testing guinea pigs. And that's how they would often try out these new drugs on groups provided by the government, the military, the churches. That's one of the reasons the churches go ballistic at the sound of my name, because they know that I'm sitting on this evidence. And this is not about sexual abuse that can be resolved with a bit of money and apology. It's about crimes against humanity. And so in a true and just world, these churches, the heads of these churches would be in prison right now. They'd be facing trial for doing exactly what the Nazis or the Pol Pot or any of these
they've
people
have
ever done.
For hundreds of years.
Right.
Not like
it's not new.
Well, they've had a lot of practice. Why do you think so good at it? and they're sort of dead to it. I mean, emotionally, they can set it.
Yeah.
Because you or me, I couldn't order any of this. I couldn't participate in any of this. I couldn't even be aware of it and allow it to continue. So this gets a bit into the psychology of it.
Right.
And there's power, right? It doesn't matter whether you're...
Power at a cost, what's your opinion? What is the cost? And how can they have that thought process?
What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose their soul? I mean, it doesn't, but I don't believe we're dealing with human beings in a conventional sense, because when you're, and I saw this up close, my fellow clergy, they all backed off except one guy who, and when I got fired, he went to bat for me, and he lost his job for doing it as well. But all of these other clergy really had lost their capacity to make a personal moral choice that went up against the institution. They had surrendered their own conscience for the sake of this institution, and that's a form of possession. I think in a very basic sense, these institutions are, and when you look at their impact in the world, they're like demonic entities, and they have the power to possess if you give them your allegiance. Because why else or how else could clergy who talk about the love of Jesus and supposed to act like humanitarian people turn around and know these crimes against children occurred, know that child trafficking is still going on, know that any child rapist in the church is automatically protected? There was a man in the United Church who, right here in Ontario for 30 years, Russell Crossley, his name was. He was a minister all through southern Ontario. Every time he raped women in his congregation, he was protected by the United Church officers and moved around. He was eventually brought to trial in Victoria. The same year I got defrocked. He never got defrocked for raping his congregation, but I did for bringing out the truth of the stuff.
For talking about it, yeah.
He went back, he did 3 months in jail. He went back, welcomed back to his congregation. He retired on full pension in 2006. So what kind of institution does that? And allows the torture and killing of children. And yeah, certainly nothing, no group that has anything to do with Jesus Christ.
When you talk directly to these clergy, what is the justification of? How do they justify?
They won't talk to me anymore, but back then.
Back then.
They don't try, first of all, they deny. It's like talking to people who have terminal cancer. There's ages, the whole stages of anger and denial you go through. Right. And you'll stay stuck in anger and denial unless somebody comes to you and gets you to see the truth and accept your ending. Well, it's exactly the same here because they out denied. When I first showed them the evidence, they just denied. They said the church couldn't do that. Well, here's statistics showing half the children died. They say, oh, it's just due to lack of funding. They continually rationalize in their mind to avoid looking at the fact that it was a conscious decision. Christians took children, put them in these institutions, murdered them, and justified it all along because you can use religion to justify anything.
Mm.
Because if God's on your side, you have the right to wipe out anybody. That's in our tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you kill,
you'll save him.
Well, it's not Christians do it, Muslims do it. Anybody who thinks God's on their side will do this.
And I notice your point. Is that...
That's my... I was going to hold that up. This
was
is the,
that your...
This is my little plastic piece here.
Yeah.
I'm Superman when I put that on.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah, and you change your whole...
That's not good, so I better throw that away.
No, you should keep that. That's a good reminder.
Actually, I use this on protests because under the Canadian Criminal Code, if I'm a minister engaged in my function, if I'm stopped, I can be the person who doesn't can be arrested and go to jail for 2 years. So I like to wear this on protests to say to the police, you know...
If you arrest me,
you're violating your criminal
code.
2 years
in jail for you, pal.
Or, yeah.
That's great,
but,
yeah.
Are you, like right now, once you got fired from the United Church, does that not no longer make you a...
No, I'm
How do you take God out of man?
I think it made me more of what I was believing in, actually, to lose my job from a child reaping institution. But all they did was take away my livelihood, my ability to earn a living. They didn't take away the ordination, so I still do a lot of that function is community minister, but not in a church. That's
not true.
Not in a church. No. Well, you're so busy now traveling around. You've been traveling around all over Canada. Have you any other? Tell us where you've been.
All over the States and Europe. In the last 3 years, I've spent a lot of time in Europe, in London, Ireland, all over Europe. We picketed the Vatican on 2 occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Had a symbolic exorcism there. Which is really fun.
That's cool.
It was covered in all the media all over Europe. And that's one of the reasons that we're having the support we are now, because the world is aware of this now.
Right.
We didn't allow it to stay confined to Port Alberni or Canada, but this is a global phenomenon of child torture and murders.
And has been a
long time.
Yep. For a very long time. How do you feel about everything now, looking back on it? Do you feel that you've found your place, that this is what you're meant to do? Do you feel happy in your heart?
I always have. I always felt good inside that I did the right thing, because even when I lost my kids and my family and my livelihood and faced all these attacks, poverty, the whole bit, you can live with that if you can live with yourself. And I always was able to look at myself in the mirror. I still am. And I'm able to look at my children, and my daughters are grown up now, they're in college, and I'm telling them the whole story. So I do feel good. I'd do it again. And it feels good to be liberated from your complicity in murderous institution.
Right.
And that complicity is something we all have to look at and find a way of separating ourselves from, or these crimes continue. So, yeah, it was the right choice, and I just hope more people will make that choice, because it's needed. You know, this isn't just some superhero act by me. I just did what I thought was right, and more people can do that.
And there are other people.
Yep.
There are other people out there doing that. You know, speaking about it, talking about it. But I'm sure because you're a public face now, you must get bombarded with emails and letters
all the time
and phone calls.
They run about 99-1 in favor, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I only occasionally, I get death threats, I get attacked, you know, there's the usual kind of harassment that goes on, but it's overwhelmingly supportive because people can't deny this stuff anymore, you know.
So. Have you had any very serious threats? Mm-hmm. Yeah? What sort of examples? I mean, with the kind of radio show we have, our guests are all...
Yeah.
We have free energy inventors on our show.
Oh, yeah, well...
And you want to talk about something dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah, because you're threatening big oil and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Physical attacks, an enormous smear campaign, misinformation campaign directed at Native people so they won't talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Censorship, you know, attempts to... Well, my family was broken up. All my network tends to get targeted if I get too influential.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe let's start from the beginning. Like, all, you know, the history of
how that whole
thing came down.
Yeah.
Well, I talked about some of it already. I mean, in terms of, I wrote a letter to the church about their stealing Native land and selling it off to logging companies.
But how did you start into this? Like, how did you start investigating, or how did you come up with
it? The very first instance of it, I think, is
that... Oh, I talk about it in my film on repentance,
yeah,
where
yeah.
The very first Native home I visited, they told me a story of a Native child being killed. That was in the fall of 1992, a man called Danny Gus. He said he saw his best friend beaten to death and buried in the hill behind the school by a United Church minister. And the clergy know about it, and all the church people know, and that's why they weren't inviting him into the church. I had asked him why there were no Indians in any of the white churches, and he said that's one of the reasons.
Mm.
Because they're all guilty. They know about what happened in these schools, camps. And it just started from there. Yeah, at that point, I could have decided to just ignore it.
Yeah, there's two roads you could have taken.
But
you could have said, okay, I'll just do my sermons to the white congregation, and
I was told
that's none of my business. That was their history. I'll just leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Or the road you did take.
I could have, if you don't mind saying, I could have left my balls at the door and continued to be a clergy, but that's actually expected. You know, ministers are to be the servant of everybody, and not to do anything to rock the boat. And that's understood, that's part of the job description. But it seems a strange way to be if you're to be a moral example in the community and preach from the Bible, which is Jesus was not a pussyfoot. You know, he confronted the powers of his day, and he got killed for it. So in a way, how dare they quote the man, right,
yeah,
when they're going to act like you know, spiritual eunuchs.
Mm-hmm.
Moral idiots. So,
yeah.
And that's in fact the camp most of them are still in.
The camp most of them are still in.
Yeah.
So, how did the attacks continue when you're after that?
Well, I mean, it was as soon as it was clear that the church was going to remove me, they went to my ex-wife and helped to pay for her divorce. They said they'd help her with the divorce if she left me and provided them with information, which she agreed to. So I lost custody of my two daughters. They were only 6 and 3 at the time. They went around and made sure I didn't complete my PhD at the University of British Columbia, which in a way was a good thing because it allowed me to publish this and
right.
make it public.
Gave me time.
And I took all of this, it was going to be a PhD thesis, and put it on the community, so that was better. But it was a horrible time for me personally, and it was designed to destroy me, to make me either kill myself or just fade into oblivion and crawl away and die, which is what most whistleblowers do in that situation. Because it's what they did is right out of the handbook of how do you
right.
deal with a corporate whistleblower. And it's not unusual. But by bringing so much attention to me, they didn't calculate that by not going under, what they were doing to me was actually fueling the fire.
Yeah.
And the more they attacked me, the more it helped. And it's that kind of jujitsu move. The more they bring attention on me, the more it brings this truth out. So
mm-hmm.
they, frankly, I think at this point don't know what to do because they can't kill me. It'll make me a martyr. I'm too well known.
Right.
If they ignore me, this truth keeps getting out. So they're really in a quandary, and the main people that have to protect them, the church and government, are the Native leaders, because they can act like, and what they often do, the government-funded Natives will say, oh, we don't support Kevin Annett, he doesn't speak for Indians, only we do. Well, I never claimed to speak for anybody but myself and addressing my culture about the crimes we did. So they have their Native puppets, and they're their main front line of defense, but the reality is that most Natives and whites now realize that they've been complicit in these crimes, and they want to do something about it. They know this government TRC is
Have you seen a change in that?
Yes.
Since, say, 4 years ago?
Ever
Has
since.
Has there been an evolution?
Yep. And 10 years ago, when we started doing protests outside churches, we got a lot of harassment from people. Nowadays, when we go out, virtually everyone going into that church nods, doesn't say anything. The police come, they look the other way, they can't look us in the eye. We've even had cops come up and tell us they're behind what we're doing, you know, and people in the church all the time. So, I mean, that even happened in Rome when we were there, you know.
In Rome?
The Vatican.
Tell us about the Vatican.
Well, I mean, I went there first in October 2009, and I did a symbolic exorcism. And it was interesting, the next day, for the first time in 40 years, a tornado hit the center of Rome.
Yes.
Ooh,
and people said, hey, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. You got some mojo.
for whatever reason that happened, it certainly caused a tempest, because I got a call that week from a fairly senior cardinal in the church who said that, you know, they had gotten our letter, because we had written to the Pope asking for him to identify where the children were buried who had died in Catholic schools. Never heard back from him, but the cardinal contacted me through a back channel, and he said that they'd be willing to talk about it at some point. But that same month, whether or not, again, it's related to what we did in Rome, but the first news stories began to hit about how the Pope, Joseph Ratzinger, is personally involved in covering up the torture and abuse of children in the Catholic Church, ordering bishops to cover that up and not tell the police. His signature's on the letter. So he's personally on the line for this. And after that, the church went into damage control mode, and they didn't talk
about it. Then any work with you guys was
right
out the
window. It caused a breach. And to show you, when I went back there in the next April, when we gathered again, the state police showed up, swarmed us, wouldn't let us near the Vatican, and wouldn't let us talk to the reporters. They were getting really worried at that point. But this coming April, there's going to be an international convergence of survivors on Rome. On April 8th, which is Easter.
April 8th.
And okay. They're going to try to form a human chain around the Vatican.
Now, if there's people that want to get involved in that,
yeah.
Who do they contact you?
You could contact me, Kevin_Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, at hotmail.com. You can follow on our tribunal website, the International Tribunal in the Crimes of Church and State. It has a website, itccs.org.
Okay.
And that's on the card. I'm sure you could post that for people.
Yeah, I'll be posting all of your links.
And that ITCCS site is the one to keep updated about all of this, because we have reports from all over the world. We work with groups in 5 countries that are all doing this work. The group in Ireland have organized occupations of churches, protests, and that's one of the reasons the Irish government severed diplomatic relations in Rome with the Vatican, if you can believe it.
Oh, really?
They withdrew their ambassador from Rome last month. They said recently they're going to bring in a law where a priest will go to jail for 5 years if they don't disclose child abuse. Now, that's unprecedented in Ireland. And that shows you the effect that we're having in this whole campaign. People are really demanding change now.
That's good.
Okay, you've got some cases in your book, and I'd like to talk about them. There's one about a guy named John Sheephumper. Sheep Shanks. If we could get some information on him in that case.
Yeah, well, this man was an Anglican church missionary from England. He lived from 1834 to 1909. He was one of the early Anglican missionaries in British Columbia. He was also a member of an inside clique that involved members of the government, the early colonial government there. And they were all part of the Anglican Church, and they were all shareholders in something called the Puget Sound Land Company, which was owned by the Hudson's Bay Company. Now, what this man did in a nutshell is he went among the interior British Columbia Indians, the Chilcotin native people. There was at the time about 10,000 of them. And within a year of his arrival, that was down to a few hundred. Because what he did is he deliberately inoculated them with smallpox. And he kept a journal about this, how he did it. He inoculated these Indians. And prior to the inoculation, he and his fellow company shareholders had preempted the land. Now, in Canadian history, you can preempt land if there's nobody on it. If it's owned by an Indian family and a missionary came and built a house there, they would preempt it, the government would give it to them, the crown. But in this case, they preempted it before any of the people had died, which they couldn't do under the law. But it was allowed because the government knew that these Indians were all about to die. Because Sheepshanks was a guy on the ground killing them all off. So he described how we went in a big arc. And this researcher in Quesnel, British Columbia, Ben Swanky, he's a librarian there. He went through all the newspaper archives and documented this systematically. He's done a movie about it, and he goes around BC lecturing about it. But
What's the name of the movie? Do you remember?
I've got to look it up. I will. I'll look at that.
Okay, we'll get that.
But What Swanky tells me is, and shows in the book, is that, I'm sorry, it's Tom Swanky.
Okay.
A librarian in Quesnel, British Columbia. So Tom Swanky showed that when Sheepshanks kept his diary of how he was inoculating all the Indians, he went in a big arc all the way around British Columbia like this. Yeah. And you follow the arc of his activity, and it's where the smallpox epidemics broke out. And all of the land that he was inoculating on had been preempted by the Puget Sound Line Company. So in the case of the whole town of Quesnel, B.C., it's a vast killing ground caused by this Anglican missionary, John Sheepshanks. Now, what's interesting is he not only got a payoff in a lot of land, but later in life, he became an archbishop in England. He became the Bishop of Norwich, and he sat in the House of Lords. So he was paid off big time for doing this.
So he was rewarded
at the behest of the crown. He was acting at the behest of the crown. Otherwise, why would he have been allowed into the House of Lords and be given that position in the British establishment after?
Right.
So that is an example from Canadian history of how the genocide happened. It was deliberate. It was planned by a church working with colonial governments and line companies. And it's interesting, when the United Church of Canada was formed in 1925, if you look at the United Church of Canada Act brought in by the Parliament, it gives the United Church the powers of a bank. They can make money, they can issue promissory notes. I often wonder, why would the church be a bank? Well, if you're the first ones into an area and you're grabbing all this land, you become land brokers.
Of course.
Right.
So that's behind the mask of these churches. They launder money, they deal in stolen land. That's the issue that got me fired. I discovered that the church had been doing that. The reason the boot came down on me so quick is they thought, oh boy, if he discovers this history of church corporate collusion, he's going to discover this one day.
Right.
And sure enough, it came out anyway, but that's why I was wondering, why were they firing me without cause and destroying my family for writing a letter?
Yeah.
And in another place, it wouldn't have caused as much of a problem, but in that place, it definitely was exposing the church's history of this kind of collusion.
So there was more points to the story that they didn't want you to dig too deep.
That's right.
Because if you did, you would find out all of these other connections, as well as the connection of, we were talking earlier about smallpox, mm-hmm. and blankets, and also tuberculosis. Maybe you could give us some of those points.
Oh, well, there's another case right here in Eastern Canada. And it's again described in my film Unrepentant, which you can see on any Google search.
Yeah.
And on hiddenfromhistory.org. The British general, Geoffrey Amherst, went in 1749, he was fighting the Mi'kmaq Indians to drive them off their land, and he kept a journal, which is now being quoted and published by the Mi'kmaq people, and in it he ordered a Major Bouquet, who was his subordinate, to go into the hospitals, get smallpox-laden blankets, and distribute them among the Mi'kmaq, and he describes how he did that. So we reprinted part of the journal in my book. And, you know, Amherst went on to become a big guy. Amherst, Nova Scotia, is named after him. His picture is in all the portrait galleries over in England. You know, he's a great hero who fought the French and the Indians. Hmm. But, you know, out in Outer Warfare, and that's how Canada was founded, on that kind of mass murder, just like America.
Just like America.
Yeah.
So this is all through North America. Europe as well, I mean.
And South America. And
South America.
As well.
Yeah.
And the Vatican especially. I mean, that it came out of Rome, this whole mentality, the papal bulls in the 1400s that authorized all this, was based on the assumption that if you weren't a Christian or a Catholic Christian, you didn't have a right to your own land. You occupied it, but you didn't own it because
right.
you weren't a Christian. I mean, that was explicitly.
It went hand in hand with the crown.
Right.
I mean, the crowned and the royals were, it was the right hand and the left hand, weren't they?
That's right.
And then they controlled the military. And through the politicians mm-hmm. that got into power.
Here's an example of that Amherst diary. That's Geoffrey Amherst on the bottom and his excerpt from his journal. And the quote is, "You will do well to try to inoculate the Indians by means of blankets, as well as to try every other method that can serve to extirpate, that's kill, this execrable race." Oh, it says also, "I should be very glad your scheme for hunting them down with dogs could take effect." You know, so they were using dogs and smallpox blankets to kill off all the Mi'kmaqs they could find.
Right. They didn't even consider them humans,
no.
did they? They certainly didn't treat them as humans.
Well, in practice, we still don't. You know.
The current and connecting to the current problems that are still going on. And what are some of the current problems that are still going on?
Oh, with Native people?
Yeah.
Well, a death rate that's just as high as it ever was 50 years ago.
And why is that?
Well, because
you think they're still using them as guinea pigs, like you
they
said.
They are. Well, you know, take for an example, in the destruction of the families is continuing at an ever-increasing pace. There's more Native children in white foster homes now than there were children in residential schools. I work with Native families where the police can come in and take the child out of the arms of the mother and never go through any review procedure or any legal process because they're Indians. How many Native people are killed in police custody? Vancouver has the highest rate of death in police custody of any city, yeah. And two-thirds of them are Native.
Really?
Yeah, I've listened to a number of shows on CBC.
Yeah. So people say, why does that happen in BC? Well, it was the frontier. It never changed this plan of open season on Indians. Most of the homeless people in Vancouver I work with have been forced off their land by their own chiefs who signed deals with water companies, oil companies, timber companies,
right,
to get the land.
Hydro companies.
Mm-hmm.
To get that.
Alcan 2, Camino 2 project, that happened. They went in and flooded the land without even telling the Indians because they made a deal with the chief. You know, that happens all the time.
Right.
It happens here too.
Yeah, yeah, because one of the descriptions I had through this friend of mine up in Wapple Island is that, you know, the chiefs are, you know, in control, whereas the, you know, the little people don't have nothing. They can sometimes they have to walk a few miles just to go buy food and then win it.
Yep.
Because they don't have a car, they don't have nothing.
What can they do?
In 1991, let me just comment on that. In 1991, I worked in Toronto when I was still in the United Church at Fred Victor Mission, which is still the biggest United Church mission. And I found there was drug dealing, money laundering going on in the staff. That was proven by people on the staff. The RCMP wouldn't refuse because wouldn't investigate. They refused to investigate because it was the church. But, you know, one of the things that was clear from that was that there was this kind of understanding between the government and the church that they could do anything they wanted and they would not be held liable. Well, why do you think that there's not one person who's ever gone to jail for the death of a child in a residential school when 50,000 or more of them died?
Yeah, and the government version of what you're talking about is CPS, Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services are just another extension of this or the crimes that are being committed against immigrant children and all children. I mean, they're killing them like outright, and they're putting them in, taking them away from mothers and families that are fully capable of looking after them and giving them the families that have a record of child abuse. I mean, this has been...
Well, the thing to understand is that it's the child trafficking networks in Canada operate primarily within the government system itself and social services. There's a former social worker, Rob Nicholson, who wrote a book called Stolen Innocence.
Ah, yes.
In 1995.
Yeah.
And he showed how known pedophiles... Now, that's a word I don't even like to use either, because in Greek it means friend of children. And this is a deliberately used word to confuse us as to what's going on. The child rapist, let's just call it for what it is, child traffickers, child rapists, they operate right within the government system. So there's a network of police, social workers, judges who are all in the network, and the others don't rat on them at all. And I learned this working on the streets of Vancouver 20, 25 years ago, too, you know. You know who the dirty cops are, and the other cops just look the other way, right?
Right.
In the case of judges, it's even more blatant than protecting one another, protecting child rapists. Two Supreme Court judges were named as being members of the Vancouver Club who were bringing children in. We even had them on film doing that. And the lawyer who tried suing them got put in a psych institution. His name is Jack Cram, back in 1994.
Really?
So, yeah, that's a notorious case of breaking the child trafficking ring, trying to. The Vancouver province was going to do a series of articles on it. It was shut down by lawyers for these judges. It goes on and on like that. But Rob Nicholson's point is that you can't detect the child trafficking now. Occasionally they'll throw somebody to the wolf so the media can feed on them. And, you know, like the guy in Penn State University, everyone gets angry at him for 3 minutes, not realizing there's a whole system at work.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
How does 100,000 children go missing every year in North America?
There you go.
Unless it's done systematically.
Well, what about the... this is sort of a left-field question, so I'm known for that. But what about the occult influences, the occult practices and the ritual? We've had guests on our show talking about some of the ritual stuff connected to the Catholic Church as well, mm-hmm. and secret societies and, you know, the story.
Well, it's interesting you say that because one of the people I worked with on Vancouver Island, she wrote a book called Michelle Remembers. And it's her story of as a little girl in Victoria. And Victoria was named as one of the major satanic ritual centers in the world, mm-hmm. Geneva, Victoria, B.C.
Yeah. Victor, Victoria. Victor stands for Lucifer,
right.
Lucifer.
But Michelle, as a little boy, or I say a little girl, was brought in. She was raised in, there's whole covens of satanic families. And they have women as breeders who bring, who have babies so they can be sacrificed, because child sacrifice is part of the whole ritual of living off of the energy, the blood of the innocent.
Right, right.
Now, that is an implicit idea in Catholic Christianity, too, you know, the saving power of the blood of the innocent. So it's tied in very much with that theology.
Right.
But and the children are all born sinful, all of that nonsense, right? But what, in this case, she was raised in this family. She was used sexually from, like, age one on. She watched other children get murdered, and she went into deep analysis about it. She wrote a book about it. Her psychiatrist, who was documented all, died of a heart attack when he was bringing out a report of what had happened to her. But what she said is the main place this happened was in the basement of a Catholic church in Saanich, British Columbia. That's just north of Victoria. And, you know, I've had a lot of experiences of, okay, I'll tell you, right, my first day, my first presbytery meeting, that's Comox and Nanaimo Presbytery. It's the regional gathering of clergy on Vancouver Island.
Okay.
It's like where the ministers get together three or four times a year to discuss church business and all that. Well, at the very first presbytery meeting, I was the youngest minister there, the new guy on the block. I was 38. This older guy comes over to me, and he starts talking. His name is Oliver Howard. He was my predecessor at St. Andrew's United Church. And he used to be a missionary on this mission boat that went up and down the coast of the Indian villages, right?
Uh-huh.
He was tied in with all of these guys who had done crimes that turned out subsequently, including Dr. George Darby, who would go around sterilizing Native women at this hospital whose records we can't see anymore.
Right.
Anyway, Oliver Howard comes over to me during the presbytery meeting. He sits down and we're chatting away, and then he looks at me very strangely and he says, well, you know, it's easy to get children around here. And I just, it was like a comment right out of left field. I said, what? I didn't know what he meant. He said, oh, you know, if people want children, it's easy to find them. And then I just looked at him really oddly, like, what are you doing? What are you suggesting? And then he kind of, it was a probe to see if I was interested.
It was a test. I was going to say, that's just a test.
Yeah.
He wanted to see if you were like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And if I had to say, not even in terms of me personally, but what my reaction was, he would then know if I was safe.
Right.
Somebody could, and the fact that I didn't look safe and I was questioning him said, okay, I go on a list of somebody not to trust.
Right.
It's like in that cop in movie Serpico, right?
Yeah.
His line in the movie is, the honest cops can't be trusted, and they never are, because they might rat out the others.
Right.
Same, even more so in the church. They identified who, and I went on a list, and at that point, that's why I was taken out so quickly, because I was already on the radar screen.
You were already on that list.
But it shows you how deeply embedded that is. And another example of that is, well, I mentioned that Russell Crossley, the United Church minister, who got moved around and finally only did a few months in prison.
Right.
He was protected by the church. There's a camp counselor, Quamis, in Surrey, United Church camp. A known child rapist was hired at this camp, and one of the camp workers notified the police about it. She gets fired. He doesn't.
Yep.
Finally, he's brought to trial and is convicted. But even after he's convicted, she's not rehired. Now, what does that tell you? If they're not going to acknowledge, it's because there's more people in the church doing it.
Well, again, she was being used as an example.
Right, and just like I was. Mine was the only public defrocking of a minister in United Church history. It was a show trial to scare everybody off.
Right.
Because I was sitting on dynamite. And it goes on and on. I mean, just when I left Vancouver a few weeks ago, it turns out First United Church, which is the main church on kind of the downtown Skid Row area, a woman said that they church workers at night, there's a drop-in center for homeless to sleep in the church. They'd been raping women in the church for like a year, and nobody reported them because they'd been hired by the minister. This was another known offender.
Right.
This goes on openly. They can hire known rapists, and they cause this crime, and they get away with it, and they never even... So it's proof that the church can do whatever they like. They're a law unto themselves.
Law unto themselves.
Yeah.
And the connections with the occult and the rituals, and like you said, you were aware of that and 25 years ago, and but not to the depth.
No,
but you're like aware now.
Peeling back the onion skin, and like the rabbit hole keeps going a lot deeper, right? Keeps getting
and it probably messy. There's probably a lot more to it.
Oh, there is. We're just scratching the surface so far. But over here, like for example, in Brantford on these grounds, every day we're hearing more of these horror stories. People literally walking in the door here and saying, "Oh yeah, I saw a kid killed. Now I can talk about it." Now they often say, "Oh, we've been waiting our whole life for somebody like you to come along and to say," because we can't do it as Indians. We're too, basically, they're too, in many cases, just too traumatized from this, mm-hmm. right? But I think that's why the system feared me so much for so long. It still does, because I had credibility, educated guy, you know, minister. People listen to me.
Right.
So
right.
All they can do is just discredit and circulate rumors and lies about me so people won't talk to me. And that's, short of killing somebody, that's how you kill their
reputation. Yeah, but the people that do talk to you have these stories,
yep.
which give you more information.
Yep.
We were talking earlier about, since your film is 4 years old, you're considering doing an updated version because there's so many more gaps that can be filled at this point, and so much more information has come out. And when are you thinking of doing that, or is it sort of a, yeah, I really should get on that sort of thing?
No, it's in the works as we're talking.
Okay.
But this film is going to be looking at child trafficking today. It's going to be looking at how it's impacting. We're going to be naming the names. It's a lot more, in a way, more dangerous than the previous one. So
okay.
We have to be more careful, need more security. And we
and the first one was pretty darn dangerous.
Well, we operate with little or no money, so
right.
We can all rely on people in the community to help us. That's what takes longer.
Right. And hopefully a bunch of people will order your book and help support you that way. I'll have a link, like I said, on the site. I urge anybody to get that book because that helps, you know, pay your bills because, this is what you do now. This is your life.
This has been my purpose for 15 years.
Yeah. Traveling around, finding out more information, talking to people, consoling people, understanding, doing the preacher's job without the church.
Which feels pretty good, actually.
Which is really sort of an organic way of doing it,
yeah.
isn't it?
Well, it's supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's not supposed to be a big institution with a lot of money and genocidal agendas, right?
Yeah, I heard one of our previous guests say once, the religion as an institution is the last refuge of the human ego.
Yeah, sure enough.
And so that's very interesting.
What would it take for an individual to be able to bring charges against somebody?
In Canada, there's nothing you can do about this. Canadian courts will refuse to act on it, as they've done for years. There's two alternatives. International route, trying to get this hearing in, you know, International Courts of Justice. There is a thing called the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction to hear these cases of genocide against heads of state and
no, but I'm
heads
like
of churches.
Some, if an individual who, let's say, got raped, right,
yep.
and knows the perpetrator, could they not bring him to justice in any way?
You mean just being raped?
Yeah,
let's say there was one of the people that were in the institution who
yeah.
know that the preacher
well,
raped them.
You
and
can
still...
always bring charges against somebody who rapes you. The
mm-hmm.
conviction rate is very low. Canada's one of the lowest conviction rates in the world for that, especially if it's a child. Stephen Harper just changed the criminal code, making it more of an offense under the law to own a pot plant than to rape a child.
Yeah.
Minimal sentence 1 year for child
okay.
in Canada. It's the lowest in the world. So your chances are slim to none about getting justice through the courts in Canada. If you're an Indian, there is no chance because it's already been wrapped up in an agreement whereby the churches can never be prosecuted for any of these crimes. So the international route, Native people are setting up their own courts under common law under their own land law jurisdictions saying, you know, well, we're going to try our own kind of justice because the crown justice doesn't work, right?
Right.
People on the West Coast are beginning to do that in the Squamish Nation.
Okay.
Some of the Anishinaabe in Manitoba. And we've suggested here to the Mohawks. And they have that own tradition in the Longhouse anyway of doing, having their own authorities. So I'm
right.
hoping that'll spread.
And the Council of... there was somebody once said, if we let our nation with a Council of Grandmothers, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing?
Well, traditionally, that's the way it was in many countries, including European, our European ancestors. had that as well. Matrilineal societies. Yeah. Common law came out of that tradition.
It's true.
You know, that's the roots of common law is in Saxon tribal law that said the law shall harm no one. It exists to protect the community. It's not the result of a sovereign telling you what your rights are and removing them when they like it.
Right.
The Roman notion, canon law, right. You know, Napoleonic code and all that. Common law is a very radical thing and a very good thing if people practice it, but they don't know it exists because we've never been taught it.
And they're so caught up in admiralty law that they don't realize that they have innate rights. You know, do no harm to others, have no harm done to you. You know, it's really simple when you boil it down. We had Rob of the Paget family there. He had built his own home, an earthship, fully off the grid, raises organic, he has an organic farm, organic chickens, you know, no chemicals, all the good stuff. Stuff that the Indians knew a long time ago, and if we would have, you know, did more learning from them instead of the other way around, brainwashing them, if we would have learned from them, maybe we'd be living healthier right now.
We have to go back to that, otherwise we don't have a future. And I don't mean just copying Native people, but going back to our own kind of inherent knowledge and the things that, that, you know, at a young age, they try to drive out of us.
Right.
What they say, ultimately, what's the story about? It's really about discovering that for any society like ours to function, it needs to traumatize children at a young age in order to make them part of a hierarchical, kind of corporatized, dehumanized society.
You have to beat that individuality,
right.
Individuality and humanity out of them.
And that's inherent in European child-rearing methods, where it was believed the child was willful, had to be battered into submission to authority. I remember the quote from, there was the guy who ran the death camp at Auschwitz, Haas his name was. He said, he wasn't psychotic, he wasn't a criminal in his own mind, he was just a law-abiding German citizen. And he said, at a young age, he was taught that the most important value was obedience to authority. And he had moral qualms, actually. It was very interesting to read before they hanged him. He wrote a whole kind of account, personal account. And he was actually quite a humanitarian guy. But he sat there and he allowed these people to be murdered in his death camp, just like the principal here and the teacher stood by and let these kids killed, thinking they were okay individual, but knowing that there's a higher allegiance he had, and that was to the authority. Even if the authority was saying kill children, kill
even humans, if the authority was wrong.
Even if it's wrong, you're supposed to suspend your own moral judgment. That can only happen if that's been battered out of you at a young age. So this is hitting on a very fundamental issue. It's just elites rule through the destruction of natural childhood innocence and autonomy and the wisdom of childhood. Like in indigenous cultures, you don't harm children because you learn from them.
Right.
You learn about the natural order. They instruct, you allow them to grow up naturally like a tree, right? And instead of being pruned every 3 seconds, you know, by which is what happens in our culture, right? And so that's a deeper lesson for all of this work that, you know, I think this is what the threat represented by my work is that we're saying, well, if that, we shouldn't allow that to happen to any child, you're challenging the whole hierarchical basis of their power and control.
It comes out to, it sort of comes out to the excuse, I was just following orders.
Which is not an excuse under international law anymore. You can't make that defense anymore.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, yeah. Well, there's a thing in 1950 called the Nuremberg Legal Precedence. And, you know, of course, the Western powers are all hypocritical because they were doing all the same crimes at the same time.
Yeah.
But in this case, at least you take the principle and it says, if your government is engaged in war crimes or crimes of aggression, like Canada is in Afghanistan, like America is in Iraq, you have an obligation not to pay taxes because you're colluding in crimes against humanity.
Right.
And the Germans, after World War II, were not tried for genocide. Genocide was never put on trial in Nuremberg. They were tried for planning and conducting a war of aggression against non-belligerent nations. Well, that's exactly what
we're
doing.
Yeah.
So under the Nuremberg laws, we'd be up on the witness stand, but winners are the ones who write the.
It's the cognitive dissidence, really. They charge the Germans, but then drop napalm on entire villages. You know, cognitive dissidence.
Yeah,
really.
Like our atrocities are more moral than theirs. I mean, it doesn't work that way.
I think back in the ancient times, the excuse was, well, God's on our side. And we're supposed to kill you heathens. So it's okay.
The Jews are doing it to the Palestinians since they've been
there. The examples all over the world.
That
sickness in us that unless you address this stuff, it's going to just keep continuing. And that's, I guess, one of the other purposes I found in life is to draw those connections to show that we're the ones who are sick. We're the ones who need the healing, folks, not the Aboriginal people. Right?
And we're unsane. Yeah. We're not insane. Yeah. We're unsane, as Michael Tesserian says.
Right.
And we've had him on the show, and he talks a lot about this sort of psychology behind the pathology, the psychotic thought processes that go on to justify the acts and the cognitive dissonance that goes on, and how we can justify actions and talk about other actions as being bad and evil when our own actions are reflective of those same actions. But you can use this word spell power magic to change the meaning of things.
Yeah. You know, but everybody tries to justify their own way.
That's true.
Whatever is beneficial to them. Right?
But this is a mass. You know, these are mass skills.
But a lot of it is us.
I agree.
You know, we try to justify, you know, whatever action, wrong or right, that we do. You know, and. If it doesn't, might not fit you.
right.
I feel it was okay, so hey, so I do it. You know, and when you get into larger groups that are controlling situations, then, you know, it just becomes more exacerbated.
Yeah, it just becomes more extreme, doesn't
extreme,
it?
Extreme, yeah.
Extreme.
And that's been going on for probably, you know, hundreds of years, if not longer.
So what is upcoming? What are your upcoming, it's, what's the date today?
Today is the
21st of November tomorrow.
21st of November. And so what do you got coming up for the rest of the winter and next year? What big events do you have coming up?
Well, there's the work we're doing here is really important because it's involving the first time the masqueraders are being opened in Canada.
Oh, right, yeah.
We need, by the new year, this information compiled in a report that we're going to take over to Europe. Excuse me. Events related to that are really significant because we've got groups coming from all over Europe to look at this evidence to converge on Rome on Easter Sunday and April 8th, and we're kind of building everybody towards doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a first of its kind.
And that, like you said, is a cooperative effort?
Yeah, groups in Ireland, England, Germany, Italy, Australia, America, Canada. I mean, they're all, this is igniting people everywhere. I mean, everywhere I go, in the last year, I've probably spoken in 50 to 100 cities all over the world and smaller communities. And I've seen so many indications that the human race is really waking up now.
You've seen that?
Everywhere I go, you see the same
thing. So you, like, we're not just talking about a hypothetical thing.
No, I see it.
You're literally seeing this.
I'm seeing that if you stay in the bubble world created by the media and that, you think things are pretty bad. When you get outside that and you just look at people on the ground, very, very few people support the system anymore. They just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They don't see an alternative. But not having an alternative is not the same as agreeing with the system and going along with it.
Right.
If it was up to each individual, I'd say 90% of the people would walk away right now from the system, but they've got to see an alternative before.
Right.
Most people are like that. They're not going to do anything if they think there's no chance of it working.
Right.
It's very few of us who actually are willing to go out on a limb all the time and have a snap and get up and keep going and, you know, have a vision of another world and keep fighting. And we have a responsibility to keep doing that for the others. But people are yearning for that now.
You still catch me napping one day and
And I trimmed a little bit off the end there in order to make it fit to the time constraints. If you'd like to download this show or any previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests, you can do so from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
They'll take your money.